last time we talked about a fair number of George Harbin's photography projects over the years, and we're going to begin and let George tie this up a little bit and talk about some more of the groups of projects that he did that we didn't get to last time. Go ahead, George.
Okay, every time I went to New York, in the early 60s, and I was selling pictures, you know, to magazines and all that, or I had to take them down and show them to them, or they'd call me and say, can you bring pictures down? Every time I went to New York City, I always took my camera with me, and through with my business in New York, so I just put the film in the camera and all that, and started photographing people on the streets of New York City. I was fascinated with the people of New York. I mean, how they were scurrying from one place to the next, almost oblivious to each other, you know. And I thought if I could try to show these people of people living in New York City on the streets, and you often wonder where they were going and what they were doing and things like that. I decided to start photographing, and I did. I would take two or three rolls of film usually when I was there into the night. I got on the bus at the Port Authority building, you know, and that's where I got the bus to go home. So I photographed in that general area, you know, around Times Square and Fifth Avenue and up Sixth Avenue. And at first I was shooting the photographs kind of straight, you know, I was trying to get sharp images and all that. The camera was very unobtrusive. In other words, I kind of hit it, you know. I usually shot from the hip. I never unless it was something that I could see that I could photograph and capture, I put the camera up to my eye. But most of the pictures I shot from the hip or from the front. That way I was able to get more spontaneous pictures of people. As I moved along in this project, I started to move more and more into the abstract and using slower shutter speeds. And then I was getting kind of almost abstract images that didn't even look like human beings anymore. They were taking on dual shapes and different forms and stuff like that. Especially later at night when it got a little darker and my light was falling and all that, I was shooting slower and slower. Like maybe a 15th of a second, you know, or sometimes a half of a second or something like that. And I was quite proud of those pictures. I never did anything really with them, but I always thought that was another nice project that I was able to complete and show some results for.
Do you have any thoughts, thinking back on it, how that project compared to your Tokyo work? Japan, because it was also city streets.
Very difficult, because in Tokyo I really wanted to show the people. So, and the people in Tokyo, not all of them, but most of them knew I was taking their picture too, you know. Or if I would stand in the middle of the pavement, I saw somebody coming toward me. I had no intention of hiding the camera or something like that. And I didn't fear at that time that I should. Because there was no one going to clobber me or anything like that. But sometimes in New York, you know, you point a camera at a person, you know, in New York, you don't know who you're pointing it at, so you got to be very careful. Yeah, but they were all together. And then the results are like 100%. I mean, they're so different. You know, they're very different. Yeah.
So there's a fair evolution in that.
Oh, yeah,
in that group of photos, from when you started doing New York, being more just straight photographic, to being a bit more expressive.
Right. Yeah. And you tried to show the people in New York as they were different type of people too, you know. And there were, like I said, people scurrying about, going to different places, and going home, going to work, and all that. Seems like everybody's passing each other. I also sometimes even tilt the camera, right, where I, instead of having straight images, I'd have them tilted or something, have the people walking on angles or something like that. So it worked out pretty good. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what other projects after the New York one have you in your portfolio at this point?
Well, then I think we should mention about the Molly Maguires.
Good.
Okay. I took for Paramount when Paramount came into this area to do a movie, they selected Eckley as one of their prime shooting scene places. And when Joe Boyle was the editor of the Times News in Tamaulipas, and Jim Thorpe at the time, in fact, he owned it with his sister Gertrude, we decided to go up one day to see what they were doing, and they were in the process then of digging up the streets and taking down all the wires and everything else to make this into an old 1870 mine patch town. And I started photographing the town as, you know, as it evolved into a movie set. And when Paramount came up and they started to shoot up at Eckley, I took some pictures and all that and printed them, came home, printed them. A few days later, took them back up, and I saw the PR guy, and he said, well, these are nothing unusual. Our photographer could do things like this, you know. So I thought, well, I guess he could. So I went home, and I had a grain screen. It's a screen that you put down over your print as you're making it. It gives it a real dirty old look, you know, and a rough look. So I printed up a dozen or so and took them back up, and he said, well, now these are different and all that. And as they were shooting the different scenes up at Eckley and all that, I was able to get on close to the set, and from that group of pictures, I compiled enough pictures to as I was able to put a book together in a couple of years afterwards. This was in 67, I think I put the book out in 69. But the photographs got that old nostalgic look to them because they're with the green screen did them. After the movie came out and it was going to be shown across the country, they used some of my photographs in their advance brochure. And they printed it in black and white. You know, the movie was done in color, you know. And so they printed this brochure in these stark black and white pictures. And I remember reading a review in Argosy magazine. It was a magazine out of Chicago, I think. And the fellow couldn't wait to see the movie because he said, "Boy, this is going to be a great movie. All, you know, with the theme of the Molly Maguires and their history." He said, I'll be so glad to, he was looking forward to seeing the movie. And when he walked into the movie and it came on and I saw this bright color and everything else, he was kind of disappointed in it because he felt if there was ever a movie that should have been shot in black and white, it should have been the Molly Maguires, like I said, with the theme of the murders and the labor violence and all that. And they kind of prettied it up a little bit. I understand later on they did it for television rights. They get more to show a color movie on television than they do on black and white. They said, I think that's why they did it. But we had, we got to know Richard Harris and Sean Connery and Samantha Egger and Marty Ritt, the director, and
what'd you think about how that film interpreted the story, since it obviously
I
it's a story.
I was a little disappointed in it. I would have liked to have seen more of the scenes, maybe when they were arrested, you know, in jail, and how they were coping with their life in jail. Of course, some of the mine scenes too were weren't very good either. Yeah. Because I imagine most people who never were in a mine, it never bothered them, but it bothered me because the sets, actually there was no scenes that were shot in this part of the country. There were sets were made in Hollywood or California someplace, and they took drawings and pictures back, and then they made a set back there, and that's where all the indoor scenes were shot, indoor extra. And they looked at two. I think if they could have got into a mine, like even like the number 9 mine or something like that, you know, and got the mud and the dirt and everything else, and they'd been much better off.
My recollection is, and I saw the movie some years ago, is that it makes an awful lot of this love affair.
Yes, oh yeah.
And so that it really, so much of it turns around a love affair rather than turning around issues of discrimination or class differences. So it loses the edge that the Molly Maguires had.
Yeah, lost a big edge there too, because and there's so much, and there was so much history written about the men when they were waiting trials and they were waiting execution and all that. And the condition of the cells and the condition of the towns, you know, the people, how they were reacting to the how everybody was against the men, everybody on the street was against them and all that. And it wasn't a good movie. I guess it's an entertaining movie.
You were kind of glad to have the story be the subject of a film. But I know I was disappointed with how they handled it, and the feeling that it's not going to be made again very soon.
No.
So that the opportunity was lost.
And at the time, they spent a lot of money making it. I don't know what it cost, 16 or 17 million, which was a lot at that time. And I thought you expected something better.
Yeah. And with Sean Connery and Samantha Egger, they had some of the leading film stars of the time.
Oh, sure. Harris, you know. And Marty Ritt at the time was one of the top-notch directors, you know. So you had the people, and James Wong Howe did the photography, and he's a legend in Hollywood. So I mean, you had good people there. But the script, I guess, wasn't there. I guess it was Arthur Lewis, wasn't it?
I don't know the script, but I'm sure
I think it was from his book.
They probably were not asking very many historians. To comment on or to help them shape the way the plot developed. And that's, of course, a big part of whether it has any historical truth there, or whether it's kind of a fiction set with a realistic backdrop.
Well, anyway, the pictures I used in the book were actually not set pictures. In other words, these were pictures I took between takes, and things like that. And from all this group, I was able to compile enough to go with song ballads from, Corson's book and all that. And I put them underneath the pictures and all that. And it worked out pretty good. The printing's not that great in the book.
So what you did is, you told the story of the Mollies.
Yeah.
On your own.
Yeah.
Through this recreation.
Yeah.
Well, from when they were shooting on the set.
Yeah.
And from the folklore.
In the early part of the book, I used a lot of newspaper clippings and all that, and told the real story. But I think what the pictures showed was the costume and the dress, the children, how they dressed, and how the women dressed, and how the men dressed, how the miners dressed. And that way I was able to get all these pictures of people and all that to go with these stories and go with these mind ballads and all that, without I mean, they were ready made, you know.
Are there drawings from that time period, for instance, would like Harper's Illustrated or would the Frank Leslie's Illustrated News have covered this event a little bit and given some drawings?
I never saw any.
I'm not sure,
but I've never seen any photographs of the original Molly Maguire trials or anything. The only pictures I've seen were taken by George Bretz, and they were portraits of the condemned men in Pottsville.
Oh, he did do that?
Oh, yeah.
So wow.
Yeah, George Bretz, he was a Pottsville photographer, and he had photographed the Mollies in Pottsville, but after the hangings in Pottsville, his studio caught fire, and he lost all his negatives. So the only thing that was really left was some of the pictures that people had purchased. He made these cabinet type cards and all that, and people. So But no negatives have been ever been surfaced. You know, it's too bad. I mean, it's a part of history. They got a pretty good idea what you know, what Campbell looked like and Doyle and Kelly and all that. Yeah, through these photographs. George Bretz was an interesting photographer. He was one of the first photographers. Well, he was the first photographer to photograph inside of a coal mine. That was the Coroner Colley up at Shenandoah.
There's a good book that came out a few years ago.
Yes.
From the University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
That's the one, yeah. But
so those negatives have survived from that period, I think.
I don't think the negatives have survived of that either. I think
what survived... Those are just prints?
No, lantern slides. And these lantern slides also have survived Bretz's work, because I understand he used to go around to different community functions like fire halls and all that, and he would show the slides and, you know, charge admission. And I think he had a group of these lantern slides in his wagon that weren't destroyed by the fire, and that they survived. These slides are also down at the University of Maryland, in their collection.
So it was from those lantern slides that they made the prints in the book.
That's right, yeah. You could make, in fact, Lance down at the Canal Museum has some lantern slides also, you know. So that's how we got into the Molly Maguire thing. And as you mentioned, the movie was... I doubt whether anybody else could make a movie. I don't know if it would be saleable or not, you know, or in this day and age. But it's a fascinating story, the Molly Maguire.
Yeah, no, it really is. And it's a story, my sense is, that is very alive here in the... in Carbon County and Schuylkill County.
Well, especially right here. I mean, we're sitting here in New Miss Patterson Street, and practically in her backyard. I mean, just maybe 100 feet the next street down is where Alexander Campbell lived, you know. And directly across the street is where John Jones lived, who was the mine superintendent who was killed, and who, for Alexander Campbell, was eventually hung for his, or hanged for his death.
And they both lived on Ridge Street?
Ridge Street, yeah, all within, the, you know, I mean, with 300-400 yards, feet from here, you know, right up there. So it is rich in history of the Molly Maguires, yeah.
Do you remember if the Molly Maguires were something that you were conscious of growing up?
No, I wasn't.
Is this a more recent phenomenon, the revival of interest in the Mollies?
First I really got interested in the Molly Maguires with my sister Rosa, who lived in Connecticut. We mentioned her. Decided to do a story, write a fiction story on the Molly Maguires as Franklin Gowan as the main character, you know. I mean, he was... And she started to do research in the Molly Maguires. At that time, I was out of the service. I was doing freelance work. So I had a little time, and I used to go over to the Foxville Library and copy newspapers and all that for her and all that, make prints for her and send her up to her. And that was my first... The people didn't talk about the Molly Maguires. I think what broke the ice was the movie. What broke the ice was the movie. I think after that, everybody kind of resolved. I don't think the people that were against the Molly Maguires wanted to talk about it. I don't think the Irish wanted to talk about it. You know, I think they all had kind of, I don't know, skeletons in the closet or what, but they just wanted to forget about it. But when a movie came out, it kind of changed things around. Say, hey, it's been long enough now, you know.
Seems like in the 5 years that I've been, you know, coming down to the Panther Valley and doing work, there must have been several reenactments of the burials, a mock where people gave testimony and reenacted, where a jury found them not guilty.
Yeah.
As I recall, there was a symposium in Pottsville about this.
Yeah,
Judge LaValle may have done something about it in his book. It seems like there have been half a dozen.
Yeah, I went to the mock trial in Jim Thorpe when Judge LaValle had it, and it was quite interesting and all that. They brought all... they had the people dressed up just like, you know, in the 1870s, and with the accents, you know, heavy accents, and it was very interesting. Of course, they were found not guilty then by the jury, but Well, I imagine the way the trials had transgressed, you know, nowadays probably, you know, they would have been thrown out, you know, the kids. But in those days, we can't get into that because that's a whole new story.
But given the kind of liberties that with Franklin Gowan
and the coal companies had.
Coal companies basically being the prosecutors for the case.
Yes, yes. And what, yeah, it was Gowan and a lot of these other small coal operators, like Daniel Shep in Tamaqua, very small coal operator, just had one colliery in Tamaqua, was very powerful, you know. And he was very instrumental in seeing that Alexander Campbell, you know, was finally hanged. He was, I was just over in Tamaqua the other day, and they had a shooting of Yost, you know, the policeman, Benjamin Yost, and we went up to the Oddfellow Cemetery, and we found the tombstone of Johnny Jones, you know. There is no stone for Yost, but there is a huge one there for Shep, Daniel Shep. And there is also one there of the doctor who took care of Yost when he was shot before he died, you know, and he's buried.
And Yost was a coal and iron police person?
No, he was a town cop. He was a town cop who was supposed to have beaten up one of the Mollies or something like that, and they said they were going to get him. And of course, Kerrigan was supposed to have been in on it. And, no, he was the town cop. In fact, he was lighting the street lights on the ladder, and when he was up on the ladder, he was supposed to have been shot. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a legend that is sort of revived in a way in your lifetime.
That wasn't a legend. Yeah. That was an actual fact. In fact, there was, I guess there was four people were hung for his murder, you know, in Pottsville, you know. Rorty and, you know, I forget the, I, you know.
Yeah. I mean, in a legend, I simply meant a story or an event that people lost interest in for some period of time, and then...
I think that through the years it's been embellished and, you know, and added on here and things like that. And there's been so many books written, as you know, so many books written on that everybody has their own opinions on it.
I remember.
Which I had too, you know.
I remember reading an account by Wayne Brohl about the time that I took my orals at Columbia years ago. So it was a story I was familiar with. Okay, well, why don't you talk a little bit about some of the other places your work has been exhibited? You mentioned them to me a little bit before we started.
Oh, yeah. Well,
today.
When I was working at Bethlehem Steel, Ricardo Vieira, the curator of prints and teaches art at Lehigh University, found out about some of my mine photographs. And one day he came up and looked at it, and he said, "Well, I got to show these, you know." So I said, "Well, how many do you want to show?" He said, "Well, I got four floors, you know." I said, "Well, how many prints?" They said, "Oh, I don't know, 100 or whatever, you know." I said, "Okay." So I went out and bought some paper and started printing these mine photographs. My mine photographs into 16 by 20, you know, putting on 20x24 boards and all that. And eventually I had a show. The first show I had in Lehigh was 112 prints, you know. And then a few years later, there was another group of pictures, separate pictures that I printed, and they were, I think it was 52 then. So they have, they have about 160, 170 of my large photographs in their permanent file. I have the largest permanent file of any photographer in the Lehigh collection. And I was always so glad that they would do that, because Lehigh was going to be around a long time, you know, and people, you know, 100 years from now or 200 years from now could go back and they'll get an idea of what miners looked like, how they worked, how they ate their lunch, and portraits of them, you know, showed what they looked like. So I was very happy that Ricardo would do this.
And very appropriate for Lehigh University.
Yeah.
Which trained a lot of mining engineers.
Oh, yes, yes.
Over the years, and which ran.
It's a funny thing. He was, you know, but it, would, it took a fellow like Ricardo, who came from Puerto Rico, to really, to really realize this. You know, most curators have, it would probably gone over their head, but for some reason he just latched onto it. You know.
It took an outsider, not an insider.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And maybe somebody came from really humble background or something. I don't know, but whatever it was. But he really latched onto it, and he's been a very strong champion of the book he just published about a year and a half ago or something, of the catalog, you know. He's very supportive of my work. Very supportive. Well, here comes Jane. What you gotta say? Yeah, I think I've had 3 exhibits down in Lehigh all told, and the last one was just, with when the catalog came out.
It's about 2 years ago now?
Yeah, it'll be 2 years in October. Mm-hmm. And I think he did a terrific job printing it, and he insisted it would be done in 300-line duotone. So, like I said, he's been very supportive. I've been very grateful to him, you know.
Well, that's probably the nicest sort of catalog-quality publication of a body of your work, isn't it?
Yes, oh yeah, yeah. That does the actual print justice. It almost looks the same, you know, because my photographs, you know, there's a lot of blacks and all that, and if you're not careful, you could mush them up and they look like nothing. And if you print them and you want to show detail and you figure, well, I'm going to white them up, I'm going to make them gray, but then you destroy the atmosphere down in a mine. You want to show the wetness and the dirt and the grime. And the only way to do it is print it black, you know. You can't print it gray or semi-gray, you have to print it black. But it takes a trick. It takes, like I said, 300 line duotone, and then you have to know what you're doing. Yeah. Yeah. He also, a few years back, he decided to, I don't know what was going on in Harrisburg. Governor Casey was there, governor at the time. Lehigh has a great collection of William Rao photographs. William Rao was a photographer for the Pennsylvania Railroad and then the Lehigh Valley. He had his own railroad car, engine, everything. He just pulled them along, you know, huge 16 by 20 cameras, and he photographed different scenes along the railroad to, for promotional purposes. They would print the pictures. There was no good enlarger, so they would make contact prints of these 16 by 20 negatives and then frame them and put them in all the stations on along their route. And some of his photographs are classics now, you know. So Lehigh, along the line, somewhere past years, someone had picked up all these photographs and stored them in the basement of the Linderman Library at Lehigh. And when Ricardo got there and he had a helper, one day the helper, Jerry Bestoni, was going through the things and came across all these William Rao photographs, I guess about 50 of them. And they had, of course, they were elated to find these things. And then they had them re-matted and on acid-free things and boards and all that. And he decided to show them at the governor's mansion in Harrisburg. And he took them down, and when he took them down, I had another, the second show I had, it was a previous show, and it showed he had it on a flyer showing the man trip at number 6, the miners, in a coal car going into the mine, and when Mrs. Casey saw it, she said, well, I want some of these pictures also. So then he had no intention of showing there, but then I had to print, 20 or 24 pictures and all that. So we had a combination show with William Rao in the governor's mansion, and it was there for a couple of months. So it was, but through knowing people like Ricardo, you know, you get your work shown, and like I said, he's been pretty good to me.
Now, had Rao done any mining photos as well as part? Yep. Because those railroad lines certainly go through mining country.
No, he never did anything in the mine. The only thing he really took were the breakers. In fact, I just gave Lance one that I picked up at a sale many years ago. I finally located it. It was one of the collieries up around Shenandoah. Mostly breakers. He did places like Jim Thorpe from the Flagstaff, you know, in Glenanoco, in the hotels and things like that. They wanted pretty pictures, too. I imagine he shot a lot of things on his own, like breakers and all that, that they weren't about to hang on walls or something. But his work is very well known, very well known. I want one, so not too long ago, one of his, through a series of various auctions and all that, I think one of his photographs went for $75,000. They were all done on albumen paper, very sensitive paper. You had to coat the. It was egg white. It was, instead of gelatin, it was egg white. Was the primary base for holding the sensitizer. Mm-hmm.
And what about your relationship over the years with the anthracite museums? Some of your work has been either shown there or is permanently at Eckley, I think.
No, I have a permanent collection up at Ashland, and that was David Soleil was at head of the three museums at the time, and he came down here. We made a selection, and I printed them up. In fact, they're still there. They're still up at Ashland, and they've been up there, goodness, 20 years, maybe more. Probably more than 20 years, yeah. I should change them. And then we had a big exhibit up at up at Scranton when David Slay was there, and they put out a nice catalog too called the Anthracite Miner. That exhibit was borrowed from Lehigh. They were all Lehigh prints, and they borrowed from Lehigh and showed them there, and then they returned them to Lehigh. Lehigh at one time had a little traveling exhibit, smaller 8x11x14 prints that they would send out to different places and all that. But I have those back now. They returned those.
So your work has really been well exhibited here in the Anthracite region.
Pretty well, yeah.